Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, September 26th. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today. We welcome back Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson to take your calls. So if you have a question about things in the heavens, this is the time. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. There's a new comet. It could be very bright. We'll talk about that. There is also now something about detecting ancient solar storms in tree rings. We'll talk about that and whatever else you want to talk about. 800-348-2551 or voxpop at wamc.org if you wish to email. It's Astronomy Today. Your calls and emails coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers in the studio today. That's twice the brilliance to answer your questions about the final frontier. We have Bob Berman, who is one of the most widely read astronomers in the whole wide world. He's the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine, the author of about a dozen books. Dr. Valerie Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her Ph.D. in astrophysical science and technology at Rochester Institute of Technology. Bob and Valerie are great guests. They're here to answer your questions. Give us a call, 800-348-2551, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Valerie Rapson, how are you?
Oh, doing great. How are you?
How's school?
Oh, it's good. We're in week five already. It's just already flying by.
That's nuts.
I know. It feels like we just started, but the students are great. We can finally get into, like, the fun material. You know, we're over the basics of the first couple of weeks, and now we get to dig into the details, so it gets a lot more fun.
Well, this is exciting, and the kids are now champing at the bit to learn everything they can about the heavens. That's great. Bob Berman, what's new with you?
Oh, it's just a great time with Saturn having just passed opposition, and just for fun, I'm having people over, not even charging them to use the observatory and seeing Saturn with this very unusual, almost edgewise appearance that it has. It only happens every 15.
So you can't see the rings.
Well, they'll be exactly edgewise in March. Then you won't be able to see them. But right now, they're almost edgewise. Mm. So it's something that only happens every 15 years. And will I be around for the next time when the rings are edgewise?
It's most likely that you will be, yes.
Well, and, you know, you start thinking about mortality a little bit.
Well, you know, if I'm going to look at Saturn through a telescope, which I've always wanted to do, I want to see it when I can see all the rings.
I know. It's true. It's true. It's like getting cheated a little bit.
Well, you know, there's this mini moon thing that's in the paper. And Valerie, it's not that uncommon, right?
No. There's all sorts of asteroids floating around all the time. And what's happening is this asteroid that has an orbit around the sun that's pretty close to the Earth just so happens to be not on a collision course with Earth, but getting relatively close.
Yeah.
Like 2.8 million miles, which is close, closer than many other things. And the gravity of the Earth is going to kind of pull it in a little bit, so it's going to make this, like, horseshoe orbit around the Earth. And it probably won't go all the way around, so it's not technically, like, a new orbiting moon, but it's going to go around us a little bit. So we'll have this little bus-sized rock in addition to our own moon for a couple of months.
Will we be able to see it?
Probably not. It's too small, and it was only discovered back in, like, August or something. You know, we had just seen it for the first time anyways. So it's really small and going to be faint, but with the largest telescopes, we can track it.
You know, we've talked about this before. My paranoia is, okay, this is bus size. If this thing actually slammed into a population center, it's bad news.
Yeah.
Doesn't it frighten you both that we just discovered this bus size thing heading our way?
I mean, the real danger is, like, the half a mile wide ones. That's, you know, city devastation and things like that. But even if the bus size one hit us, the atmosphere would kind of burn up a good chunk of it, and it probably wouldn't cause that much damage.
Bob, how big was the asteroid that exploded over Russia several years back? Do you remember?
Well, I remember it was 18 miles up, and it had a force equal to an atomic bomb. And I don't remember.
It must have been.
I think it was like 50 feet or something. I mean, it wasn't. I guess that's maybe bus size.
Something like that. I was just remembering the previous one before that on June 30th, 1908, when also in Siberia, the Tunguska event.
Right.
And the odd name of the one guy, I'm sure you've read about him, who was thrown from his back porch across his yard by the impact, even though it's 50 miles away. Semenov.
Are we sure that wasn't a comet? I've heard differing stories on this. No, it wasn't.
It could have been. It could have been. You know, what we call a meteor is anything that comes through our atmosphere. It could be cometary. It could be asteroidal. If your grandmother zoomed through the atmosphere, she'd be a meteor also. We just give that. That's a kind
Does
of
that
generic
happen a lot?
Word.
Also, Valerie sent this, and I have not heard about this until 10:25 a.m. when Val sent it. A new comet. Explain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think it's pronounced Sushinshan. I could be wrong, but there's this new comet that's it's visible for us just barely in the evening sky. You've got to have a real good view of the southeast, I believe, right now, or southwest. I forget. I'll have to
it's
look.
It's low.
Yeah, but it's real low. Okay. And it's going around the sun, and as it, you know, passes by Earth in a couple of weeks, it's going to get potentially very, very bright. Like, if we get the right, what they call forward scattering, the light from the sun scatters off the dust in just the right way, it could be -4.8 magnitudes, which is brighter than any of the stars in the
wow.
night sky.
Oh, that would be so exciting. Now, yeah. This forward scatter, can they predict it?
Well,
can
they can.
You predict it?
They can with models and stuff, and we are already seeing that this is a relatively dusty comet. It's going to have a good tail, so there's a lot of particles to get that light to reflect towards us. And if the sun is shining in just the right way and the comet's position is as we predict, I think it'll get really bright.
Go ahead, Bob.
I don't ever want to say anything that contradicts Valerie, but being a bit older than her, I've been disappointed by more comets in my life than she has. I've just had more opportunity for it. Yeah. And comets are just so famous. It wasn't just Kahutek.
That was a bummer in 73.
And it wasn't the only one, because comets, we always know where they're going to be, and they just have this habit of getting our excitement up and disappoint. I even brought a group as part of our tour group to the Southern Hemisphere, to Chile, to see a comet, and it was similar to this. Now, it's true that this comet is predicted to get to magnitude -4, that's equal to Venus.
Yeah.
But it's going to be so darn close to the sun that it's going to be essentially be a daytime object. And I think only a telescopic object, I think, and also a photographer's comet, because we all know how photography changes auroras from being just little glows that nobody can see into, like, things that look spectacular. And I think that's going to happen with this comet, too. So I'm not as hopeful as Valerie.
You're really
is.
A Debbie Downer at this point.
I'm sorry.
I'm going to be honest with you.
There's been some really nice pictures, though. I was just looking. So if you want to see it now, it's 6 degrees in the east, six degrees above the horizon in the east, southeast. But it's like Bob said, it's so close to the sun that you're starting to get twilight in the early mornings.
Yeah.
And, you know, the comet is there, but you need that long exposure picture to see it. So hopefully it'll get bright, you know, we can dream, but we'll know in a few weeks. It's going to happen like second week of October.
October 9th through 14th is what you said for the -4.8. And this is Comet Mumenschanz. What was the name of this?
Sushinshan.
It's easy for you to say.
It'll be all over the news. You'll be able to find the name.
It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. The number is 800-348-2551. If you want to jump in here, you can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. And one last one that I found, and it's pretty complicated, so if we don't want to go too crazy on it with the details, that's fine. But this was in space.com, I believe. Yeah, space.com. Scientists have found evidence of past extreme solar storms. Their return could be disastrous for our technology-based societies. We've talked about that. And, Bob, you and I have talked soon after The Sun's Heartbeat came out, which is your great book on that, about the Carrington event, which was 1859, right?
That's right, September 1st of that year.
And so explain just really quickly, we have to take a break in a couple of minutes, what happened there, and then hopefully you two can make sense of the article itself.
Well, that was the brightest flare that had ever been seen by the human race, and he was an amateur astronomer using a 6-inch telescope. 60 miles from him was another Richard Hodgson, I believe is his last name, who also saw it, And it was just the most brilliant thing. And within a couple of days, we had auroras going all the way down to Mexico. And that's when the world was waking up to, hey, wait a minute, these things aren't just on the sun. They affect us.
Yeah.
Fast forward to March. No, I'm wrong. It was May 15th of 1921 when what they called the New York Railroad solar flare happened. And at that time, we had one not quite as big as the Carrington event, but another big solar flare. And this one during sunspot cycle 15 was so strong that it caused fires to break out. It set an apartment house on fire. And then, of course, what we remember in our lifetime was the one from March 15th, 1989, when a quarter of Canada was thrown into darkness, including the city of Montreal. And again, auroras clear down into Cuba and in Mexico. And we're not talking about just the little glows that we've had here in the last month or so. We're talking about real brightnesses and detail in the sky.
Well, those events were big. But about 12 years ago, according to this article, a team of Japanese scientists discovered that extreme solar storms could produce abrupt changes in radiocarbon concentrations found within tree rings. And so they've been looking back at this, Valerie, and they have found massive spikes, AD 774, 993, 660 BC. And I guess the biggest one took place just at the end of the last ice age 14,000 years ago. These would cause massive damage.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, and it's really cool because obviously we didn't have telescopes or the ability to like truly observe the sun back then. I mean, we would have seen auroras in the sky that were visible, but now we can actually go back and try and look for any long-term patterns over hundreds or thousands of years and try and predict these in the future because, you know, had we had technology thousands of years ago that we do today, you know, these solar flares could have taken down the satellites and destroyed basically everything. So we'd love to be able to have a sense of if one is coming, you know, with more than a few hours or a day's notice so that we can prepare a little bit.
You know, you really can't. I'm sure there are other events, too, that are lesser that are found in these tree rings. But, I mean, you can't really put a cyclical time frame on these, right, Bob? They just happen when they happen.
No, the sun. Well, it's true. You know, during times of sunspot maximum, you get more of them typically. Now, we're in a solar cycle 25, whose maximum will be next year, which is why the people who join me, if I'm allowed to say that, for the for our Northern Lights viewing, next year is going to be the year. And if you don't join me, but just go somewhere,
where it's likely.
Next year is a peak time.
All right, we got to take a quick break here, and then we'll get to the phones and the emails. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC, Ray Graff with you. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. And ordinarily, we will go right to the emails here after the first break. But Jerry in Milton has been waiting a really long time already. So let's do one phone call and then go back to a few emails. Jerry, you're on. Go ahead.
Well, hello, Ray and Valerie and Bob.
Hi.
My question concerns the amount of daylight following the autumnal equinox. Now, that happened this past Sunday, and on Tuesday, I was listening to Ray Caiano, and Ray said there were 12 hours and 3 minutes of daylight that day, and I was astounded. I mean, my whole life, I've been explaining to people that after the equinox, it either increases or decreases from 12. So I've been through 136 equinoxes. And this is really shaking me now to find out that I've been wrong all these years.
Oh, my gosh.
So Tuesday, there were 12 hours and 3 minutes. Wednesday, it was down to 12 hours and no minutes. Mm. And then this morning, Paul said that there were 11 hours and 57 minutes, a loss of 3 minutes from yesterday.
All right.
I don't know how to explain this other than the fact that perhaps it has something to do with the Earth's orbit being an ellipse and the equal area and equal time thing.
Bob,
I don't know.
Bob Berman is shaking his head.
Opportunity for me to learn what happened.
Yeah. All right. Bob.
fortunately, this is an easy one. And that's the fact that you've probably heard, which is that the sun refracts or bends the image of the sun and the moon and everything that's near the horizon. Now, at the horizon, the sun's disk is bent upward by its own width, which is half a degree. So we get an undeserved extra 5 minutes or so of sunlight every day. When you look at the sun on the horizon, it's actually really set. And we're seeing like a fake sun, its image that's being refracted up above the horizon. So because of that,
we get
more day than night normally. And therefore, on the equinox, we still have a little more daylight than night. And it's almost a week later. In fact, it's probably today that's the closest day to having exactly. And it's way past the equinox now. But this is when the day and the night are really equal.
It was actually yesterday.
Okay.
According to Paul Kiano,
I believe him.
In Albany, is that depend at all on latitude?
Oh, it does to an effect in that the sun skims along the horizon to the right if you're in the far north, for example, in Alaska. If you go to northern Alaska, the sun doesn't set down. It kind of goes horizontally and only slightly loses altitude, so that effect of refraction, of raising the fake sun up, is exaggerated. And there, it's not just a matter of a few minutes extra sunlight that's not the real sun. There, they can have a half an hour of not the real sun. And so there, the days and nights inequality happens way after the equinox.
All right. Makes sense, Jerry.
Yes, absolutely. Right. So it would be the same at the vernal equinox also.
Right.
Gotcha. Well, hey, man, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. 800-348-2551. If you have an astronomy question for Valerie and Bob today, this one came in. We did a weather show with meteorologist Reed Kisselback earlier in the week. This question came in, and I suggested to Fred and New Paltz, we could throw it to you guys. It might make sense. The question is, it has been in the news lately that the Earth's core has slowed down and is now believed to have reversed. Is there any thought on how this may affect weather patterns? And that's from Fred in New Paltz.
I don't know too much. Do you know, Bob?
It hasn't reversed yet.
First of all, let's be clear about the reversal thing. That does not mean that the Earth's inner core, which is about the size of Pluto, and we used to think was liquid, but now we know is solid, is not moving in reverse to the rest of the spinning of Earth. It just means that because it's moving a little slower than the rest of Earth, if you're on Earth, which we are, and you look toward it, it looks like it's going backwards, just like when you're on the highway and pass a slower moving truck.
Right.
It looks backwards, but it's still really moving forward. So let's get that out of the way. Okay. It's not really running backwards. It's just not as fast as the rest of Earth. And something 4,000 miles under our feet, whose main effect is to produce the magnetic field, will that affect weather? My guess would be, and Valerie's guess, I'm just going to look toward her to see if she nods her head yes or no.
Probably not. I wouldn't expect too much.
Probably not.
But you do mention, you know, the magnetic field, and we don't have a full theory of how the dynamo happens. So there may be some small effects, and there should be, based on the rate of rotation of the core and the strength of our magnetic field. But this is not a change that is detrimental. It's not going to make our magnetic field go away or anything. But small changes happen all the time.
All right. This one's from Nick. Nick, there's another one about Earth. I know that the 23.5 degree tilt of the Earth is the cause of northern and southern seasons being opposite. Also, our orbit is elliptical. This might seem elementary, but how would the distance from the sun in the ellipse affect seasons and temperature if Earth had no tilt? Would we have life on Earth if there was no tilt? In our search for another Earth-like planet, is tilt a factor? How important is having a moon in the search? Valerie, you've looked a lot into exoplanets.
Those are all great questions and good things to think about that we need to consider when we're thinking about life on other planets. But, you know, the emailer is right. You know, we have the tilt of the Earth, which causes the seasons, which has nothing to do with us like leaning closer to the sun or being closer to the sun. It has to do with the angle of the sunlight and how concentrated it is on our hemisphere of the planet. So if we were completely vertical relative to the plane of the solar system, then basically, you know, the equator would have sun directly overhead, and then as you went either up or down, the sun's angle would be a little bit lower, but your seasonal changes would not be nearly as distinct as they are now. We'd all basically experience summer at the same time, winter at the same time, and it would be based more on your latitude, what you experience, as opposed to northern versus southern hemisphere.
Mm. Bob, you want to throw in?
It's fascinating. It really is. There's only two planets in our solar system that have no tilt. Well, Jupiter has only 3 degrees, which is close to nothing. We could say it really has no seasons, effectively. Mercury has no tilt. It's a tenth of 1 degree. So there really are no seasons. And on the other hand, Uranus is tilted more than 90 degrees. So there you have an interesting situation where the North or the South Pole can point directly toward the sun year after year after year and get baked, well, as far as you can be baked when you're that far from the sun. I mean, it's an 84-year orbit around the sun. So for a quarter of that time, you've got the North Pole just tilting toward it. These days, by the way, it's sideways. So you've got the North and the South Pole on the right and the left, and when you see its moons going around it, they look like they're just going up and down like elevators as they circle its equator. So the tilts are fascinating.
And it'd be cool if we could actually tell the tilt of some of these planets around other stars, but that is something that's extremely hard to see because the planet is a sphere. So from a distance, it doesn't matter if you turn a sphere. Like, it just looks like a sphere.
It's based on the rotation?
Yeah, exactly. The rotation, and if anything, you know, struck the planet. Most of the tilts for our planets in the solar system were caused by collisions at some point
in the
past.
And how do you know that?
Well, there's no reason that the planets should really be tilted. They should all be, you know, if they're forming from that disk around the sun, they should all be pretty much straight up and down compared to the plane of the solar system.
Yeah.
So we think most of them formed that way. And then, you know, collisions caused the tilts in the past. And Mars has a whole, I think it's the northern hemisphere that's a bit lower than the south. So, like, that's an obvious sign that a big asteroid struck it and gave it a very similar tilt to what Earth has.
Interesting.
And let me add something that we've said before that's fascinating and that I'm amazed that everybody doesn't know, which is that major moons go around their planet's equator. People with backyard telescopes see this and enjoy looking at Jupiter because they see, since Jupiter has that almost total lack of tilt, the moons look in a straight line, whereas Saturn has a 26-degree tilt. And so its moons can be above it, below it.
Okay.
They can be any which way. Mm-hmm. Now, our moon is the only major moon in the whole solar system that does not circle around our equator. Instead, it ignores our tilt and instead orbits us in the same plane as the plane of the solar system.
I think I've told you this before, Bob. That's because it's a completely hollow artificial spaceship. Remember we talked about that?
I forgot.
Yeah, this is from Jay. Were all the elements created instantly at the Big Bang, or did some of them get created over time?
Should I say? We only had hydrogen, helium, and lithium in the beginning from the Big Bang, the lightest element, three lightest elements. What we have in the center of stars is the process of fusion, and there is the synthesis of everything up to iron. Beyond iron, you can't get, it requires more energy than you get, so you can't get the elements that are heavier like lead and uranium, etc. Those, you need higher temperatures, so now you need a supernova explosion to get those elements. So that's how we get everything. First three elements from the Big Bang, every other element except up to iron from the inside of stars, and then the heavier ones from that from supernovae, and that's a whole story.
Mm-hmm. Anything?
That just means that, you know, Earth and our solar system is a process of recycling, right? I mean, we've got a ton of iron and heavy elements on our planet, so a supernova had to go off in our vicinity to enrich us with this material. So it's kind of neat to see, you know, the process and what happens. We wouldn't be here if what Bob said wasn't correct, right? We would have to have these supernova and these stars to give us the material to form the planets that we see.
It's Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. Dr. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman join us. The number is 800-348-2551. If you have a question, 800-348-2551, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And we'll just keep going here for a little bit with the emails. This is from Larry. So, Bohr was right and quantum entanglement is a real thing. Doesn't that indicate we exist in a computer simulation? Any thoughts?
That's silly talk.
That's
silly. Don't you think it's silly?
Don't call Larry silly.
Well, no, that idea of a computer simulation, because if this were a computer simulation, I mean, you know this, you could complete the sentence, Ray.
If it were a computer,
if this all
I'd be
were...
making a lot more money.
There we go.
Yes.
I was going to say, I love The Matrix, but, you know, it seems a little bit far-fetched. There's too much we don't know. We can't, you know, blame it on a computer simulation yet.
Okay. All right. Well, let's just leave that one for now. And we'll, if there's any evidence, we'll come back. This is from Diana in Keene, New Hampshire. I love New Hampshire. I love New Hampshire. I want to go there soon. This is from Diana, and she says, got any basic tips for a reluctant stargazer to get out there, look up, and stay interested? This reluctant one still shudders at the idea of going out to look up at night, because as a kid, my dad used to drag me outside at night with his beloved sextant to look up, memorize constellations, use the ancient tool, and try to act like it was fun. Then I married a physics major who cannot look up full of wonder for long stretches. I do live in my pretty dark skies corner of New England, which is a plus, but got any tips to bring back some level of excitement to look up, be amazed, and ideally have some fun?
Well, my suggestion is if, you know, finding the constellations and stuff is not your thing, you know, see if you can find anything else that's unique. Because when you first go out there, it's just a bunch of white dots in the sky, right?
Yeah.
And it's really hard to find constellations. But see if you can spot any colors, you know, see if you can really notice the different colors of stars and try and find ones that are red or blue or white. And look for other things like some of the nebula and star clusters that are visible with the naked eye. And see if that it maybe intrigues you more. You know, don't look for the quote-unquote boring stars, but look for the other interesting things that tell us that there's much more out there than just the constellations.
And is there not one galaxy that looks sort of like a smudged, very faint thumbprint that you can see in dark sky?
Yeah. Andromeda, sure.
Andromeda.
Yeah.
Yep. That one's going to be in the northeast this time of year, yeah.
I love looking, when we go up north or go through New Hampshire or Maine, just looking at the moons of Jupiter. There's a lot of fun to be had, I'll tell you what.
Or try a small telescope on the moon. I mean, you can have a lifetime of an exploration there.
Mm-hmm.
Or
binoculars, too.
Go to Exeter, Diana, Exeter, New Hampshire, and wait for the UFOs to return. They were there in 1966,
Oh,
it was quite exciting. But
how would you get anyone interested in any particular thing? Valerie and I were turned on to astronomy from early ages, and it's never lost its excitement. But how would you can't really convince somebody to love something or an area. It's like sort of like cat people. You
what?
Know, if you like cats, as I do, love cats. But I have friends who hate cats, and there's no convincing them that cats are fun to be with. There really isn't. I mean, so where do you go with astronomy or bird watching or anything? We all have our calling. And where does that come from? I don't even know.
Well, maybe she's got a touch of the old ennui, you know? All right, one more email, then we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones. 800-348-2551. Patrick writes, Bob and Valerie, is the Starlink network in the sky susceptible to solar flares and storms? Well, that was one thing about what we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Those low Earth orbit will be okay because of our magnetosphere?
Magnetosphere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Those the higher versions of those satellites will be in trouble because they will, you know, the magnetosphere is going to essentially shrink down closer to the Earth, so the higher up satellites won't be protected anymore. So the radiation can, you know, fry the circuit boards, and they'll also experience a lot of drag if there's excess flares or solar wind, and then the drag will slow them down, and they'll start to sink and potentially crash if they're not able to kind of reach their altitude again.
Never even thought of that. So the influx of particles will actually cause more drag. I never thought of that.
And it has already. I mean, SpaceX has already lost some satellites on accident, not from a major solar flare, but just from, you know, some sudden solar wind and a few miscalculations, and, you know, they go down.
And just a 30-second primer on what makes a higher or a lower satellite. The lowest ones are the military ones, the spy satellites, for example, that have orbits that will watch the whole Earth every day, usually several times a day.
Yeah.
The higher ones, but not the highest, are the GPS satellites that are 11,000 miles up.
Mm-hmm.
And then the highest are the geostationary ones that if you have a TV dish, that's 22,300 miles, and they stay in the same spot. because they go around the same period that Earth rotates, so that they're always over one spot. Those are the really high ones, and those are the ones that are...
What about the Webb? That's out a million miles.
Oh, yeah, and that's not technically orbiting the Earth.
It really?
It is orbiting the sun around Lagrange Point 2, but it's following the Earth in its orbit around the sun. So it's going to stay a million miles away at that position and have a tiny little elliptical orbit around nothing out there.
Is that in danger when we have a big blast, if it's
in the right direction?
Not as much.
No.
Okay.
Mm,
too far away.
Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson. And Bob Berman will be back. Gary McFarland and Up, Up and Away, 800-348-2551. And the title of that album, I guess, what is it? Something about the sun and the moon. Does the moon shine on the sun? Or I forget it. All right, then let's go to our phone lines. Valerie Rapson is here. Bob Berman is here. And Fort Ann is the place. Maureen is the poison. Maureen, you're on.
Hello. First of all, thank you for this wonderful program that you put on.
Thank you.
I just want to say to Bob Berman, about 35 years ago, you were a speaker at Adirondack Community College, and your ride never showed up to take you to the airport. So my husband and I were in the first row, and we volunteered to take you. And what was fascinating to me was that you looked at me and asked me if I was Dutch, and I'm half Dutch. And I thought that was kind of amazing.
Bob has no recollection of this.
Right, but thank you. It all sounds really great. You said something about an airport. Did I fly in for this talk? Because I used to have a plane.
Yeah, but your ride wasn't there. Oh, I see. Yeah, maybe you flew
and
the plane.
And then I had to be picked up.
Well, Maureen, thank you so much for doing that.
Yeah, thank you.
And we were careful when we drove precious cargo.
Oh, my gosh.
So you mentioned a few minutes ago about the center of the Earth being solid. And, you know, everyone, including myself, has always thought that it was magma in the center. And that's where I thought the heat that made magma come out of volcanoes.
Yeah, we used to believe that. We used to think that the Earth's core was a liquid. Now we know, we actually say there's two cores. There's the inner core, which is a solid ball about the size of Pluto. And then surrounding that, we still have your magma. We still have your liquid core surrounding that. And in fact, it's the interaction of both motions that create a current that sets up our magnetosphere. So everything works really well with that whole setup.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You want to follow up, Maureen?
Is that where volcanoes, the magma comes from then? From that liquid surrounding the center core of this solid?
Well, I guess we have to get you know what, Maureen? If you want to call on our science forum, we have geologist deluxe Ed Stander here, and he can answer that question for you.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
That's coming up. Thanks for the call. And you see, it's old home week.
I just couldn't quite understand the words.
Really? You're having an episode?
it just wasn't clear. Maybe I'm getting old.
All right, let's take another call. We'll go to James in Pittsfield. James, you're on with Valerie Rapson and Dr. Bob Berman.
Hi there. You got me?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, I enjoyed your commentary on the making of the elements, but you left out the last part, that the Big Bang produces the hydrogen helium, the star furnaces generate everything up to iron, and supernovae produce the next batch, but the latest gravitational observatories have found that the very highest elements, beyond lead and gold and uranium are made in crashing neutron stars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're exactly right about that. The heavy elements, they require even more energy than most supernova can generate. So we think that those colliding neutron stars are what's giving us that heaviest elements, including some of the gold, which I just think is fun because I always look at my jewelry and I'm like, oh, that came from a colliding neutron
but
star.
Let's always remember that the very heaviest are transient. They don't live long.
Yes, that's
so,
true.
That's very often I clarify it in my books and stuff by saying 92 natural elements because I sort of just brush off the ones that aren't going to just last. Oh. Their half-lives are short enough that they're just not going to be around very long.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You want to follow up, James? James is gone. Well, that was quick. 800-348-2551 is the number. Valerie Rapson at Bob Berman. Join us. Let's go to Beckett, Massachusetts. Andre, you're on. Is it potted up there? Mike Bowen. It's not. This is no sound now. All right. Well, what do you say we go to the emails, right? Okay. Let's see. He's gone. We can't hear him anymore. That could be a problem. All right. Let's go. Did that one. This is from Glenn in Woodstock. If life developed around another star and traveled here, with the visual acuity of humans, would we expect to see those life forms here on Earth?
I mean, as long as they were of a material that was emitting or reflecting or scattering visible light, sure. I mean, we know that a lot of life on Earth has evolved and adapted to whatever light situations we have. So, you know, our eyes primarily see visible light because our sun primarily emits visible light. And there's a lot of, you know, fish deep in the oceans that use different mechanisms or can see at different wavelengths because that's what's needed. So I don't see why we wouldn't be able to see another creature that was here unless they had some sort of, you know, mechanism to make themselves invisible to the type of light that we are able to see.
And let's always remember something that Isaac Newton knew, Roy Bishop up in Canada writes about, but very few people seem to realize, which is that there are really actually no colors and brightnesses out there in front of our eyes. So any creatures that actually, if we think of them as having brightness or color, that's not what we see. What we've been designed by nature, let's say, to experience our electromagnetic energies, and that's what photons of light, bits of light, are. They are magnetic and electrical fields at right angles to each other. That's what we can perceive. And when we perceive it, our brains, mostly in the occipital lobe in the back of our brain, respond by creating an image. But everything you see that we're trained, our language is trained, to say, oh, look at that across the street, or look at that over there through the window, as color or brightness. Color is an internal, strictly an internal experience. And so you're actually seeing parts of your own brain when you're seeing any scene that contains color or light.
I have never heard that. We're seeing parts of our own brain.
True.
See, there you go.
Wow.
And Isaac Newton was so taken by that, he wrote a little pamphlet that he called The Rays Are Not Colored. Ray, see, with your name.
Okay.
The rays are not colored, he said, because he was aware, can you believe it, 400 years ago, he was aware that we don't see color. We create them in our minds, and we see something else. Nowadays, we know what we see. We see electromagnetic energies, which we call light, photons of light. But anything that's colorful is happening in your own mind or brain.
Right.
And probably not a person in 1,000 is aware of that.
Well, it's kind of like you think about the radio waves that are around us, right? Our eyes and our brains are not designed to perceive those in a visual way. So the different frequencies are flying around us all the time at different intensities, but we don't see flashes of light that are the radio waves or anything like that, because we aren't built to see that.
Right.
All right. Let's see what else we got here. Do you think the phones work now, Michael? Michael Bowen, our engineer today. All right. We're spinning the wheel and seeing what happens. Richard is in Rensselaer. Richard, you're on.
Yeah, I'd like to know about that Carrington event. It's been, how long did it last? Because it's sort of been described like a flash, but what I want to know is, like closer to 24 hours, so it ruined the whole Earth, or would it just ruin the part facing the sun.
Well, it wouldn't ruin really anything. Remember that these flares are events that can create electrical currents along pipelines, wires. Back then, all they had were telegraph wires. Nowadays, it would be a whole different story, and we have satellites, we have electronics. They didn't back then. So the average person wouldn't have felt a thing from the Carrington event. But Richard Carrington and Richard Hodgson, I believe was his name, were observing it, and they saw it all afternoon on that date, which was September 1st, 1859. And it turned out, of course, using the proper filters so that their eyes wouldn't get destroyed
right.
by it. But nobody in the human race had ever seen a flare of that magnitude. In fact, it made that half of the sun twice as bright as it normally
Mercy.
Is. Mm. It was really a major event.
All right, Richard, thanks a lot for the call. Now, you know, devil's advocate here, if there was one 100 times or 1,000 times more powerful than the Carrington event flare or storm, it could affect plant life and human life and animal life, couldn't it? Couldn't it radiate everything?
Well, no. It's true that radiocarbon, but remember how radiocarbon happens. This happens because of an increased radiation flux. But we're not talking about the kind of things that are going to knock you to your knees. The cancer rates, even in a supernova, let's say we had a supernova mm-hmm. in a nearby star. There is no star near enough to create a supernova. Even the nearest massive star, Sirius, is 8.65 light years away, and its mass is only 2.4 times that of our sun. That's not enough to create a supernova. So we're safe from that. But from not just our own sun, but having a supernova close enough, the radiation flux increases. So what are the real effects? Evolution increases, cancer rates increase. But at the time it's happening, nobody drops
okay.
dead. Nobody
right.
drops right. to their knees.
It seems like, you know, you think of like a wind or a flare that's going to hit you and knock you over, but that's not what we would experience.
All right, this one is from Mahesh. I found a black, smooth, pebble-sized stone on one of my walks in the woods. It feels heavier than an ordinary stone. When I checked, a magnet sticks to it. How can I tell if it's a meteorite? Should I be worried it might be radioactive or anything? Where would I go to have someone take a look and tell me if it is from outer space? I live in New York City.
Oh, this is so exciting to hear that. That's so exciting because I collect octahedrites, which is the type of meteorites. First of all, it's very unlikely because in all of New York's history, there have been exactly 12 meteorites found.
Mm.
So 12 in New York State's history. The rock you found is unlikely to be a meteorite. But you did the right thing by seeing that it was heavy for its size. That's one check. That it's pulled on by a magnet. That's another check. But now I'll give you one or two more. Look at its crust. I think you said it was black.
Smooth, too.
Mm-hmm. Which is correct. Now, it shouldn't be too smooth. That's
right.
not good. For it to be a genuine meteorite, we wanted to have undulations that we call regmaglypts.
Now,
there's a word that ends with glypt. What are the words with end with ypt? Never mind that. The point is,
crypt.
People count. Yeah, that's true. Or Egypt.
Right.
But if it was made of clay and you stuck your thumb into it, it would make that kind of depression. So in other words, we don't want sharp-edged holes. That's not really a genuine meteorite sign,
okay.
but rather the kind of depressions that are sometimes called thumbprints, but whose scientific name are regmaglypts. That would be an absolute telltale sign. Now, you could bring it to a museum. They usually have a curator who will look, but they also, I have to warn you, have drawers full of things that they call meteor wrongs.
Oh, why would they keep them if they're meteor wrongs?
Good question.
Well, for things like this, so that when somebody comes and they can say, you know, that your rock is not a meteorite, but it's probably one of these other types. And
mm-hmm.
yeah, you got to have those examples.
All right. Let's see. This email from Gregory. How often, once a year in summer, does the full moon appear to rise as the sun appears to set at the same time in the Northeast?
Every month.
Right. That's by definition how it works. The sun has to be on the opposite side of the sky for the full moon to rise, because the sun is illuminating the entire side of the moon that we can see. So, yeah, every month it happens exactly at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And then this is from Joel in Blooming Grove. Is it true that the Milky Way and Andromeda galaxies are already colliding?
No.
Well, maybe.
If
the outermost.
Yeah, so that's what the more recent research is showing, that, you know, when we think about our Milky Way, we think about the constrained 100,000 light years or so, but there really is this dark matter halo and possibly incredibly low density material that's a lot farther away from the typical edge.
Yeah.
And depending on where you have the cutoff for Andromeda and the Milky Way, it's possible that, you know, some particles are colliding now as we speak, but it's not that big collision that we're waiting for in 3 billion years.
Yes. Also, you've got this. It's listed officially still as 2.5 million light years away, and between us and it, you've got two other galaxies. So what are they? Chopped liver?
Okay.
You've got the Large and Small Magellanic Clouds 170,000 light years away from us, not in the same direction as Andromeda, but still closer. What are you going to count them as?
Let them join the party.
they're already getting torn apart. Those poor things are getting torn to shreds. Like, you can see it at radio wavelengths. They don't look like circles. They look like they have tails, as if they have passed through the Milky Way already.
So cool. All right, this one from Andrew, and we're wrapping up here. We got a couple minutes. Subject heading: space explosion. I love the scene in the movie Gravity where all the space debris is flying and the domino events that happen. We keep hearing about potential sabotage in space by potential foreign actors, but what are the scenarios really? And what would really happen if someone blew up a nuke in space? How would it affect all the satellites you just spoke about? Would any of them be safe?
Well, you wouldn't have any fire and you wouldn't have any sound. So any movie that shows that is wrong.
Right.
There's, you know, space is a vacuum. But, you know, if you had some sort of explosion and there was a pressure force and enough material to have a pressure and push things outwards, then you could, you know, create some sort of pulse that could disrupt satellites. But really what you see in the movies often is an object, a satellite or something, physically exploding and tossing the material
right
in all directions.
Well, there was Starfish Prime, right? Didn't we send up a nuke in July of 62?
Yeah, and there have been some really bad characters. The Chinese were one, and the Indians recently did the same thing to prove that they could destroy an enemy military satellite. But the problem is, when you do that, you create thousands of pieces of debris, each one of which is in orbit, each one of which could potentially hit the hit something you don't want to hit, including destroying your own satellites.
Right.
And so supposedly there's a gentleman's agreement we're going to stop doing that, destroying satellites. But
oh, really?
Let's see if that happens.
Because, you know, most countries are such fine gentlemen, so I'm sure it's going to work out. You know, that Starfish Prime, though, that nuke was exploded at 250 miles. Is that technically space?
Mm. Yes.
Yeah, that's above.
50-something miles is
all right,
space.
We're almost done here. Bob Berman, if people want to follow you and find out what's going on, how do they do it?
Oh, thanks. Yeah, to come along in one of our trips to astronomy places like the Atacama Desert, et cetera. Yeah, just do Bob Berman tours, and that'll take you to where you want to see it.
All right, Valerie Rapson, if people want to find out more about the planetarium and potentially the observatory over at Oneonta, how do they do that?
Yeah, suny.oneonta.edu. Just search for the planetarium. You'll find all the info. Come see me.
Fantastic. Well, this was a fun one. Thank you both for being here. Hey, thanks to everybody who pitched in the lockbox today during the roundtable panel. You guys have been great. Don't forget, you can make your pledge 24/7. You can do it right now if you want at WAMC.org. The goal is to shorten the fund drive October 14th. We would love to get it down. So make your pledge now, and then you know what? You're guilt-free. Support comes from Stinging Nettle Apothecary, Main Street, Catskill, New York, offering handcrafted organic herb-based products, incorporating natural herbal remedies into daily life. StingingNettleNY.com. And the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, providing more than 40 miles of trails for nature therapy and exploration beyond the shore of Lake George. Hike LakeGeorge.org. Once again, thanks to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for stopping by. Thank you for listening. Great calls, great emails. Sorry if we didn't get to yours. thanks to Mongo Bowen, who's doing a great job over there at the controls. James Farrison screened the calls today. Okay, I'm Ray Graff, your semi-professional announcer. Tomorrow on the program, it's a Food Friday, and we eat healthy with Holly Shelowitz, saying a silent prayer that she doesn't bring kale. We'll see you tomorrow at 2.